So we knew we needed a big table.
We have to respect your foresight.
We're back in.
Sorry about the interruption. I would have momentum there.
So we're back on the matter, docket number FIC 2022-0555. Cindy Herblis versus Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Public Works.
Again, sorry for the interruption. That was a fire alarm. We couldn't help you. So just identify yourself again.
Oh, sure. Michelle Gibbons, Acting Agency Legal Director for the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you. Do you know where you were in your argument?
I think I was, I made mention that in, you know, number 13, so I spoke about number 12, where,
yes,
you know, we, the department believes that it actually, you know, going back to number 21, where Attorney Perlman, you know, made mention of that there is no evidence or testimony.
Right.
Other than, you know, what was provided to IT, number 12 reflects that, you know, certain individuals who had what the department believes, you know, are the responsive documents were contacted. And then in number 13, Attorney Perlman also, you know, makes reference to the fact that the HR director responded to us indicating that she didn't have any more responsive documents other than what was originally provided to us. So my whole point in bringing this up is that I think the way number 21 is written is that it gives the impression that the department only reached out, you know, as far as IT and the former DMV employees, and that we did not do, you know, a proper search for the responsive documents other than that piece of number 21 where it says, you know, with the exception of emails of former employees. And that was from, that was the IT piece of it. It's not indicated here, but that's what that makes reference to. So again, the department is respectfully requesting that number 21 be removed from the proposal, you know, given that the department believes that number 12 and to some degree number 13, you know, supports the fact that we actually did, you know, do an extensive search relative to the documents that were requested by Ms. Herblis.
Thank you.
Attorney Perlman.
For the record, Paul Perlman was the hearing officer on this matter. With respect to what Attorney Gibbons just said in terms of them doing an exhaustive search, it's hard for me, based on the evidence that I had, it would be difficult for me to make that finding. The respondents did not bring any witnesses. Really, their evidence was documentary evidence, and those really consisted mostly of emails where the email was forwarded to a certain, you know, different individuals asking for them to do the search. And in some cases, there were follow-up by email or maybe they got a response. But I didn't really have anything additional to that besides what the complainant had. So again, they didn't bring any witnesses. So I could really only base my findings on what the complainant, testified and what was submitted or marked as exhibits. I just felt that, you know, it's really, 21 is really, what I'm trying to say is that I don't have the details of what was searched. I know that emails were sent out asking individuals to do a search. Yes, someone had to go on the job apps employment system to pull some of the records that were provided. And I do have documentary evidence that they did a search for the emails, but I don't really have anything beyond that in the record.
When it says offer any evidence, would it be, would different language be better in that case? Because it does appear they offered some evidence or even the exhibits that you...
I guess, you know, my focus for 21 is really on the specifically detailing the nature and scope. It's not so much that I don't have, I have evidence, I have documentary evidence that they did a search because they forwarded the request to different individuals. I feel like I needed more to what, you know, what did they search?
Should we eliminate that language, any evidence? Just say provide or offer? I think sufficient.
Yeah, maybe sufficient evidence. Because to me, paragraph 22 sounds, you hate to say the word worser. Paragraph 21, you know? I mean, but Attorney Gibbons didn't raise any objection to 22. And I'm not inviting her to, but I mean, yeah, maybe soft pedal 21 back a little bit. If there's some evidence, but not a lot, or sufficient, maybe, or they failed to provide, provided insufficient evidence, maybe, something like that. I'm just playing off. I'm playing off the chairman. That's all.
Any, from what you said, the any evidence is referring to there was no evidence specifically detailing. There was evidence about other, but not any. But there wasn't any evidence specifically detailing the nature and scope of the search.
Am I allowed to comment or no? I'm not sure protocol.
Sure.
I don't know. I apologize. I don't know what protocol is. Oh, I'm sorry. Michelle Givens, Acting Agency Legal Director for Department of Motor Vehicles. In the May 24th, in number 12, in the evidence that was provided to Attorney Perlman, it does say in parentheses in the email that was provided to, you know, not to repeat myself, but the commissioner's office, the executive secretary, the chief of staff, head of HR and the HR department, it says for your convenience, Cindy's original request is attached here too. And there was, you know, no objection from Ms. Erblis when we actually had the hearing with respect to this particular piece of evidence that was provided to Attorney Perlman.
Just with respect to that, to me, it seems like they were just forwarding the requests. That still doesn't, didn't tell me what they did to search. Unless, you can, I guess technically that could be part of the search because you're forwarding the request and asking somebody to search, but I don't know what steps they took to conduct a search for responsive records.
Do any of the other commissioners have any comments or questions?
Okay. Actually, I mean, just we should be writing a wizard. But if you take out the two Ennies, I think the sentence says the same thing. I would say provide evidence or offer testimony specifically detailing. Just saying this, but I'm not, I mean, we want to say what you mean to say or what you mean to say, but if you took out the two Emmys, I think would say for most readers the same thing.
That's a nice middle ground. This is Commissioner Hankins.
I'm not trying, but if people find that a comfortable middle ground, but I think it can be read to say the same thing or not.
Am I allowed to speak?
Mr. Streeter.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, I think I agree with the hearing officer on this. I think, you know, I would leave it the way it is. That's just my thoughts.
Thank you.
I'm good.
Okay. All right. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to the hearing officer's report.
Motions from the agency. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Farish?
Yes.
Commissioner Fizeshi?
Yes.
Commissioner Bolesby?
Yes.
Commissioner DeFranco?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Ron Regan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Good job. Thank you. Thank you.
Jeff, don't worry, everyone.
Chair?
Yes.
Attorney Givens, just to say, you know, good luck. I'm glad that things are moving in a different direction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a positive way, and
it's going to be all yours.
Don't be discouraged.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. Moving to docket number FIC 2022-0568, Katie Cameron versus Chief Court Administrator, Court Operations Division, State of Connecticut, Judicial Branch. Thank you. Counsel, would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, James O'Connor from Judicial Branch Legal Services on behalf of the respondents.
For the record, Danielle McGee is the hearing officer in this matter.
Thank you. Is Katie Cameron here? Thank you. Attorney O'Connor, you have the floor.
Sure, I will be brief. The respondents urge adoption of the hearing officer's recommendation. My understanding of the background of Ms. Cameron is not here, but my understanding of the background is that she was a litigant in the small claims system. At the end of her case, she sought a variety of documents and different requests from judicial about small claims magistrates and small claims process. In this particular request, we're talking about materials that will be used to train magistrates, small claims magistrates. It's the respondent's position that these documents are not administrative in nature and therefore are not subject to the act as it pertains to judicial. As we're all aware, the Freedom of Information Act applies to judicial only as to its administrative functions. The Supreme Court has held that that should be narrowly construed to apply to the judicial's budget, personnel, facilities, and physical operations. Subsequent to that holding, the Superior Court has found that appointees are not employees and therefore are not subject to the personnel prong of the administrative test. In this case, the magistrates are appointed by the Chief Court Administrator pursuant to statutes 51-193L. And just to sort of emphasize that point a bit further as to why they are not employees, they're not paid a salary, they receive no benefits, they're not a part of the retirement system, and ultimately, I think this is kind of what the main point here is, they serve a purely adjudicative function. They are not administrative actors within the branch. They don't, the materials that we're talking about in this case, in particular, training materials, are materials used to train them in how to perform their adjudicative function. And that's why we agree with the hearing officer's recommendation and we urge its adoption.
Is there something secretive about those training materials?
Not necessarily any particular document. We would say that while these things may not be highly confidential, they are still not subject to the Act and the sort of limitations put on us by the Act in the way that administrative documents would be. That simply put, there's a separation of powers issue. If an executive branch agency would require us to disclose these types of documents on a particular time scale to a member of the public. That's sort of the greater issue that we're looking to protect in this situation.
Repeat that, please.
Sure. The separation of powers issue is...
Simply put, what was that last sentence?
It would be... What we're trying to protect here is the ability of judicial to control these types of documents. It would be a violation of separation of powers if an executive branch agency could order judicial to provide these documents to a complainant or a requester on the strict timeline required by FOIA and subject to your decision, frankly.
Danielle McGee again for the record. I think it might just be helpful just to briefly summarize the law with respect to the applicability of the Act to the judicial branch. So under the FOI Act, the judicial branch is only a public agency with respect to its administrative functions. And our Supreme Court has told us that the administrative functions are limited to the judicial branch's budget, its facilities and physical operations, and its personnel. The Supreme Court has said that the we're supposed to look at the judicial branch much more narrowly than we would other public agencies. It doesn't apply the same way as it does to the legislature or the executive branch state agencies. This case really turns on whether these training materials, which pertain to magistrates who are appointees, falls under that personnel category of records that's subject to disclosure. And in the Superior Court decision in Sargent, the court specifically looked at whether records pertaining to appointees fell under the scope of personnel. And the court says that they don't, that individuals who are appointed like GALs are not the personnel or employees of the judicial branch, and therefore those types of records aren't subject to disclosure. So I would agree with counsel for the judicial branch that in this case, we're dealing with records pertaining to the training of magistrates who are appointees. They are not employees of the judicial branch. And therefore, those materials are not within the realm of these personnel records that could be subject to disclosure. That being said, I mean, coming into this case, I really wanted to lay eyes on these records and see what they were, see if there was anything we could provide to Ms. Cameron. I spent a lot of time going through each page of the records that were provided to me. There were substantive training materials about the law that's applied, how it should be applied, how cases should be processed, things that go to the heart of the adjudicative function of the court, not its administrative function. And so I felt like there wasn't anything that I could recommend this commission discloses to Ms. Cameron based on the law. That being said, I think there may be opportunities where the judicial branch could work with Ms. Cameron and provide something to her, even though we can't order them to. There's been prior cases where that has happened, where the judicial branch has referred complainants to information that might be available in other locations that the commission couldn't order disclosed, but that they might be able to access. Because we do know that people have the right to go to the court and ask for information and know who parties are in a particular matter that's docketed, or their counsel is, or sit in on a court proceeding. Just because they have those rights, however, doesn't mean the commission can order disclosure of records that fall outside of these four buckets of information. So I do think the decision's correct. I wish I could have recommended the commission order something disclosed, but I don't think we can in this case. I hope that helped clarifies.
Thank you. Any comments?
I was just a bit uncomfortable with the decision. It just, I struggled to see how training materials shouldn't be given to the public. I don't think it's anything that's confidential. How a magistrate judge is trained. I think the public has a right to, should have a right to examine that, but I understand the law is what it is, and we have to apply the laws as you laid it out in Sargent. Still made me uncomfortable. I mean, at GAL, I can understand GAL's giving up information, private information regarding their representation of a client. No, I would say no, they're not obligated to, that they shouldn't be obligated to do that. But how a GAL is trained and how a GAL is selected, I think that's public information. I think the public has a right to know that, or should have a right to know that. Be that as it may, I understand. Is there any further comment? Yeah, Commissioner Goolsbee.
Just in focus on, I was recently appointed as a magistrate. I don't have my training materials as of yet, but I will soon. So I'm also going to abstain just from the decision, just to be sure that I don't, you know, just walk on any lines that I'm not supposed to. I'm sure it's fine, but I'd rather just abstain.
That's a good move.
But I do think to his point, you know, when I was looking at this, I'm thinking, yeah, it is, it feels like it's administrative, but true, the materials themselves are related to the adjudicative function. So I guess the way the law is written, it's something to think about. And I think, you know, I won't say too much, but I do think the small claims process in general, you know, that's one of those things where these are litigants typically that are not represented by attorneys, and they're trying to do the best that they can to, you know, seek their remedy. And then there is no appeal process to a small claims decision. So the fact that you don't even know who the magistrates are. I've looked. I don't know anybody that's appointed as a magistrate right now in the state of Connecticut unless I personally know them, because that's not public. Now, the family support magistrates are publicly listed on judicial branch website, but I don't know who the magistrates are that are appointed. The only people that know are appointed, well, now they would know because I've said it now to the whole world, but you wouldn't know that otherwise. There's no way to find that information. So I just wonder, you know, just putting this on the record and anybody that's listening, that maybe there's something in the legislature that could be done regarding just the transparency of that process overall, because I think that would be helpful. So I'll leave it there.
All right. Anything further? All right. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, from Mr. Spear, I'll move Dr. Hanoff's court.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Farish?
Yes.
Commissioner Kuzeshi?
Yes.
Mr. Goldsby? Mr. Ganschlin?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes.
Passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Docket number FIC 2023-0421, Richard Kaczynski versus Chairman, Connecticut State Board of Mediation and Arbitration. Please identify yourself for the record. Starting with you, sir.
Richard Kaczynski, and the complainant.
Thank you.
Richard Sponzo, Assistant Attorney General for the respondents, the Chairman of the State Board of Mediation and Arbitration and the State Board.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kaczynski, is that how I pronounce your name?
Yes.
Thank you. You're most aggrieved. Your friend's most aggrieved. Attorney Sponzo, what would you like to do? You don't have to stand. Thank you, though. I appreciate it.
I had sort of thought that the opening argument would be made by complainants because the finding was made against him, the principal finding concerning whether the very straightforward issue of whether the meeting of the SBMA on his application was held in open session or an executive session. And that there was finding against him, the complainant, and it was his complaint too. But in any event, I'll be happy to address the decision in its entirety. And as to the principal finding, again, against the complainant on the central issue in his complaint, I view this, and in fact, the Mr. Kaczynski, the complainant, even admits this in his brief, both briefs that he submitted to this commission. This strikes me as controlled entirely as the issue of credibility. And in that respect, the hearing officers should be deferred to on such issue. It was the hearing officer who heard and saw the witnesses, who observed the demeanor of the witnesses. All I'll say further, because I want to address the other two issues, the other two findings of the hearing officer, especially, and devote the majority of my time to those, but I'll just say further that even something that is addressed in the complainant's brief as to that the hearing was not recorded. Even that, although can be viewed in terms of on a credibility level, that in fact the claim as to that was delayed, was not involved in the complaint, as the hearing officer observed, and correctly so, was made late, basically. It was delayed, and especially significant in light of the complainant's purported reliance on that from a credibility standpoint, as well as that it's such a narrow finding on this central issue, whether the SBMA considered his application in open session or executive session, such a narrow finding that the hearing officer properly was able to rely on the testimony presented by the director of the SBMA himself at the hearing. And I think that concludes my argument as to the central finding and the opening finding in the hearing officer's proposed decision, and that should be affirmed on the basis of an credibility basis. Now, I want to address the two other findings in particular. As to, because I think they should not be adopted, or at least as made in the provost hearing officer's decision. Most importantly, the finding as to the SBMA is failing to inform Mr. Kozinski as to the resumption of the public portion of the meeting after executive session. That is worded entirely in terms of that somehow the complaint was made as to failing to inform him after the SBMA exited its executive session. And that is simply not correct. I very carefully read, if you very carefully read the complaint made by Mr. Kozinski, he does raise three grounds, all of which I'm addressing now. The central one that I did on a credibility basis. The second one that I am now addressing, that his complaint states directly, expressly, that he was denied the right to attend the meeting when SBMA went into executive session, not after exiting executive session, when it went into executive session. And for a number of reasons, both legal, logical, and in terms of the evidence, the finding is not proper that failing to inform him of resuming the meeting after exiting the executive session. That was not the issue in the complaint to begin with, but as I just stated, but in addition to that, in light of the finding, the complaint posed as I carefully read it and presented it a moment ago, that it went to only only not informing him or not having the right to attend the session when it went into executive session. That's simply a repeat of the central issue that was found against him, and that it was found against him that board went into executive session at all. It was found on the contrary, that they considered his application an open session. Also, from a practical standpoint, even if the board had to get back to him on resuming, what could they say? All they could say is this was decided conclusively by the SBMA considering his application, taking no action on it, and adjourning the meeting. That's the most it could say. And that too is not a violation of law for the simple reason that that's not denying him an opportunity to attend the meeting because there was no resumption of the meeting. In addition to that, factually, in terms of the evidence at the hearing, the director testified, and this was not directly opposed by evidence, that he told the complainant that he was going to consider the application in executive session. And I'm sorry, in open session, after he told the complainant he considered his application in open session, he told the complainant he was going on to an executive session consideration of another application, another individual's application, and then the meeting would be adjourned. In addition to that, testified at the hearing, the director of the SBMA, that he would call Mr. Kaczynski if there was a resumption of the meeting. I want to add in that respect, insofar as Mr. Kaczynski relies, the complainant relies on, in any sense, his pressing a button on the team's meeting at the time that allegedly invited him to rejoin the meeting and that he allegedly pressed repeatedly and then was advised, sorry, no one has responded. That was done just by a matter of technology of the team's meetings. That was not caused in any sense by the SBMA. And all that the director of the SBMA told him for his testimony was that he would get back to him only if the public portion of the meeting resumed, which it didn't. So therefore, he had no reason to inform him. So I think that finding should not stand. I think that should not be adopted by this commission. And I have language that I could suggest, but it's a very slight variation in the language. Frankly, with regard to paragraphs 10 to 12, it's simply that it is found that the respondent, the first sentence of that finding, number 10, should be stricken entirely. And then in its place, there should be a finding that per the director's testimony, he was advised that the director would contact him after the meeting, if the public portion of the meeting resumed, which it didn't. And actually finding number 11, even though I'm taking issue with the finding in the total of paragraphs 10 to 12, that could actually stand because that is accurate. And basically what that says is that the application was considered in the open portion of the meeting and the SBMA voted to adjourn. And on that basis, finding 12, on the basis of my argument, finding 12 should be altered. To state basically it is therefore concluded that since the public portion of the meeting was not resumed, there's no violation. No violation, not even a technical violation of section 1225A. Now I want to address just in a minute, very, very briefly, the final finding as to the late posting of the minutes of the January 17, 2023 meeting by the SBMA. And as to that, I think because there's no harm from that caused to the complainant, I think that can come within the language of the statute, section 1-2. 206B4, basically that we have a de minimis violation, particular violation at most, not causing any harm to the complainant. And again, per that statute, his complaint in that regard should be dismissed. That's my argument.
Thank you. Mr. Kubitz.
Thank you. Back in 1989 or 1990, then Governor O'Neill gamed the system by appointing two persons as members of the neutral arbitration panel of the State Department of Education. Even though those two persons did not go through the statutorily required State Department of Education review, I sued. And 2 weeks later, those persons resigned. In 1991, Governor Weicker appointed me to that panel without me seeking any political help. I've served on that panel continuously for 32 years. Now, 34 years after the O'Neill system gaming, here we go again. I have no patience with any government functionary abusing their authority. The hearing officer found that white was black. I've lived with what happened at that meeting. I know what happened at that meeting, but the hearing officer ignored what I said. What happened was I was told to leave the meeting before there was any discussion of my application. Before, but here we go, the director says something different and the hearing officer goes along with it. There's no excuse for stuff like that in this government. So let's all do a polygraph then. If it's true, why not, we should both take polygraphs, me and Director Cho. We'll see how that works out. The hearing officer refused to admit into evidence documents related to credibility. The hearing officer ignored numerous red flags, the lack of a statutorily required recording, falsification of public documents, respondent chairman's solo dialogues described as discussions. When you hear the testimony of Director Cho, not once did anyone other than the chairman speak, and yet when he manufactures these fabricated minutes, talks about these discussions, and even the hearing officer talks about discussions. When one person is talking, that's not a discussion. You need two people talking to each other. This consideration of my application with no motion, no discussion, and the chairman ruling of no action. The failure of the SBMA's members, particularly the chairman, to appear to provide information to the hearing officer, Director Cho's email that I, quote, be advised that the SBMA took no action on any application. Well, if I were there and listening in open session to that, I wouldn't have to be advised. This was the next day that email came out that I would be advised. The fact is, if I already was there, I knew it, so I didn't have to be advised of anything. So now it's in your hands, and we'll see if the state of Connecticut government can please itself.
Thank you. Do any commissioners have any questions? Anything further, counsel?
No, Your
Honor. Great. With that, I entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Street, I'll move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hackett, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none. We'll take a roll call. Those in favor, Commissioner Farish?
Yes.
Commissioner Fizashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Goolsbee?
Yes.
Commissioner Ganswit?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Paul Megan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you. Excuse me, Your Honor. I do have a question, not about the decision. I have a question, a practical question about when this decision becomes effective, when there's a written notice issued by the commission adopting the hearing officer's decision, or has it become effective as of today? I assume not.
Becomes effective as of today.
Will there be a written notice, though?
Yes, you will receive the final decision. Will come to you in paper format.
When?
Monthly notice. Within a few days.
Probably. Yes, that's fine. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So Spirit Court consideration of Spirit Court decision.
At least I have something good to report. This is Energy Policy Advocates versus FOIC. It is on appeal from the Commission's decision to the Superior Court. It involved two separate requests by the plaintiffs to the Office of the Attorney General seeking communications among various assistant and associate attorney generals, as well as communications with certain other attorneys. And in response, the OAG had provided a total of 188 unredacted pages, but also 38 pages with some redactions. And actually, some of them were duplicates, so we were only talking about a handful of redactions. And the OAG had contended that various exemptions apply to the redacted information, like attorney-client privilege, work product privilege, and pending litigation privilege. The commission determined that it was clear from the face of the records that the information was exempt under 1-210B4, which is the pending litigation exemption. So B4 exempts from disclosure records pertaining to strategy and negotiations with respect to pending litigation to which the public agency is a party. And 1-209 subsection C defines that phrase pending litigation as the agency's consideration of action to implement or enforce a legal right or legal relief. And so this exemption encompasses more than a case pending in court. It includes even consideration of taking future legal action. And so here the commission decided that all of the redacted information was exempt under those provisions because it concerned consideration of action to enforce or implement legal relief or legal right. The hearing on the merits of the appeal was on August 28th, 2023, and the court issued its decision October 26th, 2023. It's a very brief decision. The analysis was two paragraphs. Upheld the commission's decision, saying there was substantial evidence in the record supporting the commission's conclusion that is clear from the face of those records that the redacted information is strategy with respect to pending litigation. The court said the records directly relate to the OAG's consideration of enforcing Connecticut environmental laws. Now, although the decision was brief. The briefing was not, because the complainants also raised numerous alleged claim procedural irregularities. But one of our arguments, meaning the commission and the attorney general's, was that those claims were not properly briefed. And although we still had to address all of those claims, but the court agreed with us and said, and refused, or I should say, declined to review those procedural claims because they were inadequately briefed. That's what we're saying. Oh, and today is the 20th day, and it's at 4th
6:30 approximately now, so we haven't received anything.
No, me too.
They were trying to get in the building, but it was.
They couldn't serve us.
Kate is right. The brevity of the decision is nowhere near a reflection of the briefing process and the work that went into defending the commission on that one.
I thought the decision was great.
So, okay, and then under pending appeals, we just
quick, real quick. So that wonderful, Attorney Harmon, that wonderful decision we received from the appellate court that Attorney McGee argued against Bridgeport that came down and she reported to you on last hearing. We've got a petition for certification from the Bridgeport respondents to the Supreme Court asking them to review that decision. And Attorney McGee is busily writing her objection, which is due the day after Thanksgiving. And so we're going to object to the Supreme Court taking it, and we'll let you know what the Supreme Court does.
Let's see. I don't think I have anything else, really. Under Executive Director's Report, I just want to mention that the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government is having its event tomorrow. The Mitchell W. Perlman Awards will be given out there. If anybody's interested in attending, it's at 5:30 p.m. at the Mark Twain House. We do have, I have an extra ticket if anybody's interested in going. Let us know, but it should be a very positive, good freedom of information event. So I just wanted to tell you about
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, can I just add something?
Yes.
In addition to being a new FOI commissioner, this summer I became the president of CFOG, Connecticut Foundation for Open Government, and would love to have any of the commissioners come tomorrow night. It's at the Twain House, and let us know if you would like a ticket. Thanks.
Yeah. That's it. Under staff reports, we're still just working on filling our positions and moving along in that regard. And nothing else, nothing under legislative report just yet, and no new business.
Great. Mr. Chairman, I move we adjourn.
Okay.
Motion's made and seconded. I'll take a roll call with those in favor. Mr. Farish?
Yes.
Mr. Kuzeshi?
Yes.
Mr. Goldsby?
Yes.
Mr. Gantzman?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
Myself, Alder Egan? Yes.
Passes unanimously.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.